Thank you for attending this session. This is session number 264, titled Murder, Mayhem, Mormons, and Miners, Tales of Death and Violence from Utah's Pioneer Dixie. Please silence your cell phones. We ask that all here today engage thoughtfully and respectfully, understanding that we will all come from varying backgrounds and beliefs. Please be respectful in your comments and questions. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the reference desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6, at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized for just for Sunstone. There's the commercial. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Please consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within that framework and that time, so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session, you clear the room and speak outside so that other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. About this session, too often we portray 19th century Mormon pioneers as two-dimensional stick figures against the backdrop of the Mormon Restoration. The presentation, however, covers several accounts of deadly incidents and treachery that occurred among the Mormons in the Santa Clara and Virgin Rivers area, giving us a new look into pioneer days in Dixie. Our presenter is Melvin C. Johnson. Where did Melvin go? Ah, there he is. You moved. He's an independent historian and a retired college instructor. He and his wife, Hallie, a bilingual special educator, live in Salt Lake City, Utah. And there's many things that Melvin has published, and you can look that up, and you'll be very surprised and very pleased, as I was. I found out not too long ago that a book I already owned was written by him, and I regret not bringing it so he could sign it. So, all things aside, with that, I'll turn the time over to Melvin Johnson.
Thank you very much. My wife and I are East Texans and have always wanted to retire in downtown Salt Lake City, and in 2011 that became possible. The fact that I am 7 blocks from the church history library helped somewhat, and my family's here as well. I'm very glad that you're attending today. This story is an interesting one, and this is primarily, with one or two exceptions, of Mormons and Mormons and more Mormons struggling with the environment, the climate, each other. Why aren't you marrying my pregnant daughter? And the answer is because I have a wife in Ohio. And the reply is, so what? We're Mormons. You can marry her. And it ends up in murder. We deal with Native Americans, First Peoples. And I want to make a comment here against the backdrop of Mormon Native American relations in Utah, in Dixie, that the Indians had far more from day one to be scared of the Mormons than the Mormons did of the Indians. But since we are a schizophrenic people, when we were not killing them, we were baptizing them in great numbers. Dixie is a unique place. It is a world of desert, aridity, red sand, winds like you cannot imagine, dust that gets inside your sealed windows and doors every night, and you get your rag out the next morning to clean it up. Let's go to Dixie. Lorenzo Brown was a pioneer, a sawmiller in Pine Valley, and Susan Ellen Dameron Alphen was a wife. Well, a wife several times. And the story goes, he recorded in his diary in 1863 that summer day, about 5 p.m. it began to rain. And I think the hardest rain I ever saw. 1 hour, the creek raised under our mill 9 feet, but no damage. However, 8 miles down the river stream, the river raised to a roar, rushed, and this good woman was trying to save her 6 children. The flood took Brother Alphen's house, destroying everything, and drowned 4 children. They took their bodies out of the tops of the cottonwoods. Murder, mayhem, miners and Mormons. And I've changed the second line a number of times. But what we're talking about is death and destruction in a particular world that most Mormons have no idea existed. From the founding of the Latter-day Saint Church in New York, through all of the events, including the trek west to the Great Basin and all of the experiences since then, our history witnesses terrible suffering by how we treat each other and how we treat others. Climate, terrain make the man, and so does viciousness and stupidity. And honor and selfless acts. From Parowan to Pine Valley, from St. George to the western valleys of eastern Nevada, along the Muddy River south to Overton, St. George, and the great reservoirs now, and through Arizona, New Mexico, and into southwest Colorado, the LDS settlements did not escape the darker side of human experience. The sources in this presentation are generally contemporary to time and place, and they support Zane Grey's description of the Dixie experience: loneliness, hunger, thirst, cold, heat, the fierce sandstorm, the desert blizzard, poverty, labor without help, illness without medicine, tasks without remuneration, no comfort, but little sleep, so few of the joys commonly yearned for by men, and pain, always some kind of pain, injury, illness, were the Latter-day Saints' constant companion. This studies murder of Mormon men, women, and children by family members, clashes of pioneers and first people, death by rivers, and falling down quarries, and by lightning, by old Mormon gunfighters shooting each other, death by disease. I don't know how well you can see that, but that is the center of Dixie. And for me, Pine Valley is the very center. Juanita Brooks would say St. George is it. But you go from Panguitch to Parowan, west into eastern Nevada. You with me? And then down the Big Muddy to the great reservoirs and then sweep east through Arizona and New Mexico. Where do we get our history? So, if you're in the top 5 or 6 list, this is going to be a little bit different. I'm not interested in stick figures against the Restoration, against the backdrop of the Restoration. I am interested in people's lives and their incidents. However, I love reading the ensign. It's fun. Because I get it corrected as I go along. The primary historian of Dixie is James Gotson Blake. He's an Englishman, converted, came over in 1856. He was part of the Martin Hancock Company. And unlike a lot of them, it strengthened his testimony. He was called and set apart and ordained as the historian for the Southern Utah Mission in 1860. And they came down in 1861. And then for the next 39 years, he recorded annually what went on in Greater Dixie. I have transcribed the entire 2,200 pages, and I have annotated most of it. And I'm not the only one. Coffered Books has Reed Nielsen and David MacArthur from Arkansas Tech doing the same thing. If you get a chance to get one of our books, either one will be magnificent in terms of learning about things that you never imagined existed. Uh, 1881. How many of you been to the St. George Tabernacle? How many of you gone up the east steps? Yeah, we all have. And on the east steps in 1881, 9-year-old William Jarvis and his friend Angus M. Cannon were walking, and then this terrible rainstorm. And believe me, when it rains in St. George, you would think you're in Central America. And the boys ran for the east steps there to be safe. And that is where the lightning found George Jarvis and struck him dead and knocked Angus Cannon over the step wall to the ground and broke his arm. I can't imagine being a parent and losing a child that way. Jacob Hamlin, we know about him, the great Indian missionary. He comes home from a mission to the Moqui. All right, let's have a game. Moqui, who are they? Which native tribe do we know that as today? Say it, somebody. Hopi. So they have to come across the Colorado River, which was called the Grand River in those days for decades. And it was a dangerous trip. Well, Jacob had a dream one night on the way back in 1864 that one of his boys had died, and somebody had said that it was John. And he said, no, it was Albert. Albert was his 22-year-old Indian son who had lived with him for 12 years. He had been digging in a canal, and if you've been down to Santa Clara, you watched the floods on TV, and you watched the houses float away, the canal fell in on Albert, and Jacob did not recover for almost 6 months. Lewis Richard, that year, was digging in a mine. He fell down the mine shaft and broke his neck. Some 18 years later, 59-year-old Thomas Gibbs Crane was killed by falling down a mine shaft over at Ash Creek. It was dangerous every day you went to work. You might not come home. I love this next picture. John Pym. He is the sexton, the mortuary guy. He's going to build your coffin, and he's going to bury you. And he's going to register you in the official records. And I have records here from 1865 and 1866. You'll notice the Pym General Store, Post Office, and Mortuary, all in one building. He lives forever. I'm surprised he's not alive today. In 1865, in a two-week period, Hans Peter Olsen, 45, George Palmer, 40, Charles Thomas Wilkinson, 7 months, 5 days. Ingeborg Katrina Olsen, 2 years, 1 month, 5 days. Sarah Denton, 67 years, 9 months, 5 days. Skip ahead a year up to September 17th for 1866. We have 16 deaths. Putrid pores, sore throat, group, gravel. That's the guy who fell down the well. Consumption, killed by Indians. 65, that would have been Whitmore and his nephew out at Pipe Springs. It doesn't cover the 10 Indians that Colonel MacArthur and the militia killed by mistake after they tortured him for information. My friend Daniel always gets mad when I talk about his great-grandfather. But he was also a stake president. He was a temple president. He was a leading man, and one of the reasons St. George survived. So there's no two-dimensional stick figures here. These are real human beings in a tough place at a tough time. Ulcerated lungs. Not reported. 16, and he says, the health of the people in this city has been better this past year than since 1861. The gentleman is Erastus Snow, and after George A. Smith is the most important general authority in the development of Dixie and its history. Has a number of wives, a lot of children, and I have transcribed all of his journals and letters, and I will tell you he loved his family, all of them. He writes on April 23rd, 1881, to the Deseret News for publication. Within 10 days, a disease has developed among our school children. At first supposed to be ordinary sore throat, but soon became malignant. And others are sick in various parts of town. School closed yesterday. The dead included a son and daughter of Nathaniel Ashby, 8 and 5, respectively, and my own little Bertie, a son in his 9th year, the pride of the family. His mother and I found him sick on our arrival home Tuesday. We buried him today, Saturday, 30th April. Diphtheria continues to rage. Imagine being in town where there's a disease ravaging your children and you're out in the middle of nowhere. Loretta Russell, Elizabeth H. Woodbury, Grafton, 1866, 13 and 14 years old with their entire life to live in. They're playing along the side of the road, and then a machine for binding wheat, horse-drawn, falls over and kills them both instantaneously. Their skulls are shattered. Eliza R. Snow, whom normally her poetry does not move me, does in this. Because we're going to get two images here. We're getting an image of what life should be like, contrasted to what life is. And we're going to ask ourselves the question, were these girls better running out of mortality this way than remaining. And today, if we ask that question, we'll go, no, they should have had a life. The dearly beloved ones no longer dwell in the cherished homes of the mountain dwell. And that's why I don't like Eliza. 'Neath the lofty peaks that in grandeur rise and with towering summits embrace the skies, in you, sweet innocence, and this is where it changes, bright and gay, they passed like two beautiful sunbeams away, but a sudden departure. Deep sorrow leaves in the hearts. And for those of you, and I'm one, who have lost children too young, I feel what you're going through at the moment. I do every time I read. The homes, the death bereaves. Far better for them thus to dash away than endure the sad process of slow decay where the hand of sickness with anguished rife to a fearful point draws the thread of life. The second stanza continues the comparison of young death without pain to that of passing later on life's rough track. What is death? And we've all asked ourselves that one. 'Tis a passage through which way you go where the streams of life more abundant flow, where affection lives and love's holy tie is transferred from time to the world of high. Eternity's portals wide often flew, and the loving young maidens went cheerily through without sense of pain, without dread or fear. I hear Emily Dickinson in that a little bit. Had their friends the power, would they call them back to encounter perils of life's rough track? No, they've gone in innocence, chaste and pure, and to them the rich blessings of heaven are sure. This fellow is Prince Coleman. At the age of, I think he was 72, he's down in either Thatcher or Holden, Arizona, and it's time to make your leases, bid on your leases, auction, for to run your cattle on Indian land. And he and another gentleman get involved with it. Coleman is interesting. He was on the frontier a long time, no stranger to violence. He assisted Ira Hatch in tracking down three survivors of the massacre at Mountain Meadows and assisted in killing them. He ran cattle, was a constable, and became an early settler in Arizona. The New York Times, that purveyor of fake news, reports in 1903, plainsmen fight a duel. Coleman, 72 years old, packing his six-shooter, and a rancher named Henry Barrett is carrying his six-shooter, come to blows over their respective grazing permits on the reservation, which are of considerable value. I was born on a ranch, in a dairy, and a farm, and worked from dark 30 to dark 30, no days off. They can have it. And they got into a fight. They came to blows. Barrett badly bruised Coleman about the head. He had drawn his revolver and was beating him on the head. Coleman drew his weapon and began shooting at very close range. Well, when you stick your revolver in your opponent's gut and fires three times quickly, you can't get closer than that. Barrett quickly died. Oh, I guess. But Coleman, in return, was shot through both thighs and lies on the ground. The newspaper reports him as, get my good side, Steve. Oh, I forgot. I have none. Was probably fatally wounded. However, he survived another 2 years, shot another man, and died almost at the age of 74. I would have liked to have known him. First Peoples and the Mormons. When I began writing Mormon history a long time ago, I had generally thought of Mormon history as is that showing? It's not, of course. When we talk about Native Americans, I thought it was blow for blow, reciprocity. We got them and they got us. Well, we got them and then stood on them and then beat them over the head. From day one, the Indians had far more to fear from us than generally we did from them. This gentleman is Joseph Fish. 14 when he went to Parowan in 1851, lived in Utah and Arizona, a great pioneer, has a wonderful autobiography online. You should read it. It's amazing. Well, he talks about the massacre at Circleville down by Panguitch. In 1864, with the Indian Wars going on, a small fort called Fort Sanford, or Sanford with a D, was built. There were a small tribe, and I don't know if they were Utes or they were a miscreant group, but somehow ended up near the fort. They were rounded up, tied up, and then that night allegedly made an escape and were shot down. Joseph Fish and Erastus Snow later write independently, and you'll find it elsewhere, that they were taken to a mill to the basement, and man, woman, and child, their throats were cut, and then were buried. Study the picture. Look at the size of the people. Does that Native American look kind of big to you? Normally you think they're smaller than the whites. This is the Shibwits. And they are not the same people that live on the reservation near Santa Clara now called Shiv with a V, Wits. These are big people. The man doing the baptizing is Daniel MacArthur. The man on the bank, is it Angus Cannon? I don't remember. No, Augustus Hardy, the sheriff. I don't know if he's ensuring they get baptized. But over that 3 or 4 day period, they baptize almost 227 people, almost the entire tribe. It goes back to when Mormons are not killing Indians, they are baptizing them in great numbers. Goes back to the story of Laman in the future. The size of that Native American has always, always perplexed me. And you look at the background, they're big.
Where were they located exactly?
They would have been located up the Santa Clara River, just beyond Santa Clara, 7 or 8 miles from the junction of the Virgin and the Santa Clara. Now, at this time, they were the remnants of about 600 that had lived along the riverine way. If you've read your Leo Lyman and others about the Native Americans in the area, you're right in the midst of the habitat that supported the natives being destroyed to support the whites. If any of their children are alive, I don't know. And that just occurred to me. Newell, do you think there'd be records of descendants at the church history library? If they're listed by name, then it'd be a familysearch.org thing. That's interesting, and I think I'll do that. See if any of their descendants are alive. This is Isaac Riddle, the white man first into Pine Valley. He's an interesting man. He was a frontiersman from a teenager, part of the James Emmett Company that left Nauvoo in 1844, darn near starved to death until they got out to Ponca Camp in South Dakota. And it'd be 2 years before they came under Brigham Young's control again. He was a teenage hunter, 15, 16, and 17, trying to support the 200 people in that camp. My wife gave a wonderful talk at John Whitmer 2 or 3 years ago on one of the women, Lydia Knight, who on a frosty January night in 1847, her husband died. You have a picture of her standing on the frosty ground with seven small children. And that was not an uncommon picture at Ponca Camp. Riddle took those years seriously. 10 years later, Riddle is in Pine Valley, and he's looking at those timbers, those gigantic trees. And like every good white man, and me too, who worked in a sawmill, I don't see a tree that I don't want to chop down. It's one of my great sins. I want to build things with it. And so he owned one of the first sawmills. But he writes a letter to Brigham Young 2 years later. He said, I was in the valley, and this impudent Indian, there's a key word, impudent, saucy. Anytime a white man starts describing an Indian in those terms, what's going to happen? Somebody's going to get killed. The Indian says, you need to leave our valley. We want you Mormons out of here. I'm killing all your game animals. Riddle, you can get the front part of the story in Jacob Hamlin by Todd Compton. You get the back end of the story because I found the letter that he wrote to Brigham Young. And he wrote Brigham and he said, I drew and shot him down. Then put another bullet in him to make sure he stayed down. And about 2 years later, he said, I want you to know that I was rebaptized and felt bad about it. Is there anything else I need to do? I never have found a reply from Brigham on this one. And by the way, is there anybody here from the Church History Library today? No? For those of you who are doing history or family work, they do the most amazing job down there. They will do things for you that you would not believe. And I can remember 25 years ago when they were glad to show you the door. And now, Newell, will you agree with that? And they have given me things that I never ever redacted things on the promise that I use them a certain way. I have no problem with that. Otherwise, I wouldn't get them. But go online to Church History Catalog if you want to find out about your family and your history. They'll go out of their way to get you documents. I feel for Isaac Riddle. I was in the military a long time. And men and weapons and things happen in the spur of a moment. Franklin Woolley was on the other end. Fairly prominent family in St. George. He was off to California to get horses. And he did. Was coming back. And then the horses ran away from him. The party said, Franklin, come on. we'll send somebody, a group back to get them later. He said, no, I want my horses. It's that old story in the environment. What happens if I push? What happens if I flip? He didn't ask the question. Went looking for his horses, found him in a box canyon where the Mojave Indians found him in a box canyon. And his brother described it as the Native Americans doing a war dance around him and then shot him 16 times with arrows. One of the things that I've learned in my studies is that in the St. George immediate area, there's no death inflicted on one another by race. When you start reaching out further is when it starts happening. Pine Valley, Parowan, Long Valley, Berryville, Pipe Springs, Circleville. And notice that I haven't talked about the biggest killing, have I? They weren't Mormons. So we'll leave them for another time. This is Bishop Lorenzo, is it Roundy? Yeah. He's a bishop of Kanara. He's a traveling partner with Jacob Hamlin down to the Moquis, crossing the Colorado, the Grand River. I threw in the wagon above for you ladies. It doesn't have to do with Dixie. It has to do with further east over towards Hatch, Bluff, Mexican Hat on the San Juan. They are on what is called the honeymoon trail. They are taking their wagons and they're intended, and they are going to the temple in Manti and to the temple down in St. George to get married. It was a rugged journey. They must have loved each other to go on a journey like that. You can see the lower picture. What's the major problem with these horse wranglers? What aren't they doing? Look at the horses. I'm sure the horses are hobbled. They're not blindfolded. Imagine taking a group of horses on a low ferry across the river, unblindfolded. And then the ferry flips over. The water's cold. Lorenzo is a strong swimmer, and he goes down like a stone. They're picking men and horses 3 miles down the river who survived. Never found Lorenzo's body. The Davidsons. If you're living on the Big Muddy in the middle of summer down near St. Joseph or Overton in that year, and you're planning to go to St. George, you're going to go with a group of people, and you're going to take sufficient water. And they get as far as one of the little Mormon towns, and a wheel falls off. So they stay overnight, they get the wheel fixed, and the party has gone on. Hallie, remember that father and Jasper who drove that plane that Christmas into the hillside in Canada, Wyoming, flying in weather he should not have been flying in with his wife and that wonderful little boy that would have discovered cancer, the cure to cancer. This father made the same error. They went out into the desert. The cart broke down. They sent the boy off on a horse with a canteen and a keg to get water. The next day, one of the well diggers up near Beaver Wash, you know the story, find the horse. He comes into camp. The day after that, they find the boy. He's bloated. They have no idea who he is. They can't recognize him. The next day, they find the husband and the wife underneath a cactus with a blanket drawn over them to protect them from the heat. I wonder what happens if I push. Well, I can get there in time. I'm going to put these pictures up quickly. I'm not going to talk long about it. This is Silver Reef, north side of Leeds. And for about 8 years, it was a wild place. That is a little diorama model on a table. And at one time, they had 1,400 people there. And St. George had 4,000 if you counted outside. There was a lot of money made. And Thomas Forrest was a Scotsman, a non-Mormon, a union agitator. And that's fine because I've been a union agitator in my life too. And agitated against unions too. Was just a troublemaker. And the mine owner ordered him fired. And so the boss said, sure. The next day he fired Thomas. Thomas went to his little cabin, it's more a hut, and began sharpening his knife. And he says, I'm going to get him. And the next morning when the mine manager comes by, he shoots him out of the saddle, stabs him. LAO, law enforcement, catches up with him. Puts him in the little jail, another little hut. And then he thinks, I'm going to give this to Angus Hardy, the sheriff over in St. George. So they ride the 8 miles over to St. George. And that night, 100 men in Silver Reef with masks mount up and ride for St. George. 2 a.m. in the morning, Augustus Hardy is looking at these men. And he looks at his assistant jailer, and he says, we're not going to push this. And they give him Forrest. So they take him to the telegraph pole, pull him up, and the telegraph pole snaps. Mormons are a devoted, dedicated group, are they not? They do not give up. So they go to George Cottam's house, a block to the east. The tree is now, but I remember it from a boy. And when George got up the next morning, Thomas Forrest is swinging in his front yard. And his neighbor says, I've been here 26 years. That's the first time I've ever seen fruit on that tree. Mormon humor. Murder of Isaac Whitehouse. Reed Noel Cormack and Connell O'Donovan, Utah Historical Quarterly. The story will break your heart. The boy is 11. They're all converts in England or Scotland. His parents die on the journey, and he comes into the family by marriage to the Bakers, Samuel and Elizabeth. I don't know that he's mute and deaf, but there's a lot of indications that I believe that he was very learning impaired, disabled, could not communicate. And for the first part of the summer of 1855, everything went well. The boy played well with his playmates. And then on an October night in 1855, something set Samuel and Elizabeth up. They tied him up, they bound his legs, and they beat the holy crap out of him. And then in the middle of the night, Samuel drags the 11-year-old out into the fields, throws him in an irrigation ditch, covers him with dirt, and he dies from exposure. Elizabeth curses the stake president who sends her husband to trial. And the horrible thing about that is President Smith dies about a month later of illness. Very ill, very sick the whole time. All the Parowan is going, don't mess with Mother Baker. She'll put the haunt on you. He is convicted. He is sent to the territorial prison. And Brigham Young pardons him 48 days later. I'll go back one. I'm not going to talk about Athia Meeks and Alma Miller, but I will tell you about the lore. That's Samuel Burgess. And that's his daughter, Lizzie Burgess, on the fourth side. We have 15 minutes. So I will do this and then do my final and then turn it over. And Lizzie falls in love with Rance Olfen. I mean, she gives him her heart. She gives him her body. She's pregnant. Marry me. They're in Pine Valley. Everybody knows everybody. And he goes, no, I can't. I have a wife in Ohio. I told my 40-year-old daughter that, and she said, I would have shot him too. And so both Samuel and Rance go about this. How many of you been to Pine Valley? It's a little place. It's two cross streets. And they both go armed. It's not going to turn out well. Rance comes down the street with lumber or flour or something. He's got a load. Samuel sneaks out from behind the building, shoots him in the back. Well, as a soldier, that makes sense to me. A fair fight is to shoot your enemy at 300 yards in the back. Okay. He forgot that Rance is an expert shot. Whirls in his seat, draws his revolver, and does a Clint Eastwood on him. Shoots him right through the head. Boom. Rance dies a few days later. They're both buried in the Pine Valley Cemetery, yards apart. I can imagine those ceremonies. I hope they scheduled them apart. And Lizzie said, I'm going to take my newborn and move to Emory County, where she married a man and had six kids and died a long time later. I'm trying to think as I go through all of these. No, I'll go back to this one and then I'll finish and I'll do it quickly. Teresa. Grafton, her husband goes crazy, shoots her, shoots the baby, shoots Thomas Batty, who tries to interfere. Augustus Hardy has to pry him out of the rock house with a posse and kills him. We end up with two children without a dad and five children without parents. She and her sister, Marjorie Wilkerson Stewart, are wives of Levi Stewart and Kanab, the bishop. Fire breaks out. Her three sons and her sister's son is in the house, and she perishes trying to save them. Is there not a mother in this house that would not have gone back into that house in the same situation? That's courage. Death strikes the high as well as the low. Alice Young Clausen, Brigham and Mary Angel's oldest daughter, married to Hiram Clausen. Four children earlier, premature birth, dies in St. George. And if you want to visit her grave, go to the private Young Cemetery right up 50 East, right up the hill. And look to the right. It's right behind that parking lot. Six graves there. And if you're pondering tough things in your life, it's a great place to go. Now I'll move to the peroration. I'm doing this research, and it comes out of the annals, and I notice that the ground in Dixie is drenched in blood and in death. And I want to make this more than a necrology, that Dixie was hard. But what lesson can we learn from this? The lesson is this. Dixie creates a people that are devoid of sentiment, romantic sensibility, work hard every day of their lives. And you think, well, why are they that way? They grow up in this land of canyons and sand and precipices. And in those decades, who do they know? each other. They have none of those treasures of civilization that you would have had in St. George or even developing in Provo. And the perfect example is Juanita Brooks, second-generation pioneer. Her literature, which creates new Mormon history, literally, is devoid of romantic naturalism, Mormon superstition. She does not do two-stick dimensional figures against the backdrop of the Restoration. She's narrowly realistic, and she writes about normal people and what they normally do. And like Maureen Whipple, she does not hide any of it. I came to Dixie College in 1970 as an illiterate 21-year-old. I could not write an essay. I read insatiably. And my teachers were third, fourth, fifth generation Dixie settlers, descendants. And they kicked me in the butt, and they loved me, and they said, there's a right way to face life. You face it head on. And when you get knocked down, you get up and move on. And if you think you're never going to get knocked down, go to BYU. No, they didn't say that. But I was so blessed with my Dixie experience, and I wanted to share why I thought this story was important today. Thank you. And anybody who needs to leave, like Claire, everybody look at Claire, do so.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the time and energy and obviously a great deal of research that has gone into this work. We have a few minutes, so I thought we'd open this up for any questions that people might have. I'll bring the mic back to you if you want.
I believe there was a famous gunfighting sheriff in and around the mining towns of that area. And I believe he was Mormon, and he was known as a good shot, a good gunfighter, and he went to Nevada as well. Do you know anything about that, or can you comment?
I don't. And email Will Bagley. I grew up with Will. Will likes to talk as much as I do, perhaps more. And he will have an answer for you. But let me point out that in Utah territory, other than the immediate mine towns, all law enforcement and justice officials were LDS. They had learned in Illinois and Missouri not to have it any other way. That's a great question.
We want you on record. All right. I was just wondering about Grafton. And when I saw that there was a 13 and 14-year-old that were killed by a swing, I wondered if, I mean, by a machine, mm-hmm. I was wondering if they were the children that were, you know, in Grafton that said a 13 and 14-year-old died from a swing.
Swing broke,
right.
That could be one of the stories. We're good with our mythologies and stories. I know, I tell them. It was probably a horse-drawn threshing machine that fell over on the 13 and 14-year-old. They were playing by the roadside right next to the canal. 1866. Oh, no, that was in Pine Valley, south of Pine Valley along the river. That must have been 35 miles west and north from Grafton. Other questions? You are great. Oh, wait a minute. I almost got away.
So one of the things I've been curious about with Utah history, and maybe I just haven't looked in the right places, but I haven't seen much of it. Where can one learn about accounts of blood atonement? You mentioned before we started, somebody tried to blood atone somebody when you were talking with the lady over here. Where can one read about the doctrine and the practice?
If you got notes out, John Pierce Holly, his autobiography, Your Ancestor, wanted to do him in. And then the letter came from Brigham Young, and Harrison went, we're going to have to let him live. That's one. Will Bagley has done some work. You can look online. Others have too. The extent of blood atonement is probably more interesting than the actual acts, though horrifying as they are. I think in a lot of cases, and don't get me wrong, I don't carry water for Brigham Young. There were fewer incidents than we would like to think. But if there was one because of the doctrine, that was too many. And Will Bagley will argue that Mountain Meadows, and a good part of it, came from the doctrine. Others? Anybody? She's ready to go. 3, 2, 1. Thank you.